Hello, and welcome to Mystery Road. My name is Taylor.
And my name is Donovan. Mystery Road is a monthly podcast that examines the dark, strange, and unknown.
Want more updates on the show? Follow us on Instagram at Mystery Road Pod. Have suggestions and ideas for future shows? Email us at mysterieroadpod@gmail.com.
Help support the show on Patreon at patreon.com/mysteryroadpod. Now, let's take a stroll down Mystery Road.
Welcome back to Mystery Road. I am your host, Taylor, and as always, with me today is my co-host, Donovan.
Hey everyone, thanks so much for joining us today. Episode 2, it's finally here, and oh boy, has it been a journey. From getting new equipment to moving across the country, we've experienced multiple delays in finalizing this episode.
But now we're back and excited to announce we are full force ahead and ready to bring you the best mysterious, true crime, and paranormal events. Before we jump in today's episode, let's take a moment of silence for the victims and their families.
As high school and college students, we often picture spring break as a time to let loose and forget about everyday stresses of school life. Unfortunately for these five students, their spring breaks ended in tragedy. In today's episode, we'll be discussing the top five mysterious spring break disappearances and murders. We will dive deep into these cases and try to shed some light on each case's investigation, theories, and outcomes.
Number 5 on our list is the disappearance of Natalie Holloway. Natalie was a high school student who vanished during a spring break trip to Aruba in 2005. Natalie was a bright and ambitious 18-year-old senior at Mountain Brook High School in Birmingham, Alabama. She was known by her family and friends for having an outgoing personality and a love for sports. Natalie had plans to attend the University of Alabama in the fall to study pre-med in hopes of achieving her lifelong dream of working in the medical field.
In May 2005, Natalie and 124 of her classmates packed up and headed to Aruba for a week-long celebration before their graduation. They chose to stay at a Holiday Inn, a popular hotel on the island. On May 29th, Natalie went out with her friends to Carlos and Charlie's, a bar in downtown Oranjestad, the capital of Aruba. She was last seen leaving the bar at around 1:30 a.m. on May 30th with three young men, Joran Vandersloot, Deepak Kalpo, and Satish Kalpo.
The next morning, Natalie failed to show up for her flight home, and her family began to worry. They contacted the chaperones of the trip, who immediately started to search for her. Natalie's friends told the chaperones that they had last seen her leaving the bar with Joran Vandersloot, a 17-year-old Dutch national who lived on the island. Joran initially denied having any involvement in Natalie's disappearance. He claimed that he had dropped her off at the hotel at around 2 a.m. on May 30th and that she had walked to her room alone.
The Aruban authorities soon joined in the search, and they scoured the island with the help of the Dutch Royal Marines. They searched beaches, hotels, and even conducted extensive underwater searches, but no trace of Natalie was found. As the investigation progressed, it became clear that Joran's story didn't add up. Surveillance footage showed that Natalie had never returned to her hotel that night. Although Joran lied to the police, he was released from custody due to a lack of evidence connecting him to Natalie's disappearance.
The investigation took a twist when a witness came forward claiming to have seen Joran Vandersloot and the Kalpo brothers near a landfill in the early hours of May 30th. Acting suspiciously and carrying something heavy. Joran and the Kalpo brothers were arrested in connection with Natalie's disappearance. Even though Joran had now been arrested twice for the connections to Natalie's disappearance, all three were soon released due to a lack of evidence.
Despite the lack of evidence, the media's frenzy around the case continued to grow. Natalie's disappearance was covered extensively by news outlets worldwide, and Natalie quickly became a household name. In the years that followed, there were several false leads and alleged sightings of Natalie, but none of them led to any concrete evidence or information about her whereabouts.
In 2008, a Dutch crime reporter named Peter R. De Vries aired a hidden camera interview with Joren Vandersloot in which he appeared to confess to the involvement in Natalie's disappearance. Joren is heard on the camera admitting to, quote, dumping Natalie's body after she suddenly began shaking and died as we were kissing, end quote. Although the police obtained this footage, the judges rejected a third attempt at Joren's arrest. Joseph Takopina, Joren's lawyer, made the following statement after the judge's ruling, quote, my client is not responsible for the Alabama teen's death and that the tapes did not amount to a confession, end quote.
Joren's life took a dark turn in 2010 when he was arrested in Peru in connection with the murder of Stephanie Flores, a 21-year-old woman whom he had met in a casino. He eventually was convicted of the crime and is currently serving a 28-year sentence in a Peruvian prison. Despite Joren's incarceration, the case of Natalie Holloway remains unsolved. Her family has never given up hope of finding out what has happened to her, and they continue to search for answers.
Over the years, there have been many theories about what might have happened to Natalie. Some have suggested that she was a victim of human trafficking. Dutch reporter Peter De Vries also showed footage of Joren Vandersloot speaking to a sex industry boss. It was found that Joren was paid around $13,000 for every woman he sold into prostitution. Since Joren was the last to be seen with Natalie, many believe she was sold into human trafficking.
The most popular theory is Joren Vandersloot and the Calpo brothers were involved in her disappearance, despite the lack of evidence. With Joren's sketchy background and consistent story changes, people believe he's hiding the truth. The case of Natalie Holloway is one of the most high-profile unsolved disappearances of the 21st century. It has captured the world's attention and left many unanswered questions. We may never know what happened to Natalie, but her memory lives on, and her family continues to search for answers.
Number 4, the murder of Mark Kilroy. Mark was a 21-year-old college student who was abducted and killed during a spring break trip to Matamoros, Mexico in 1989. His body was found in a ritualistic grave along with several other victims. The case gained national attention in the United States and Mexico, and to this day, it remains one of the most baffling and disturbing crimes in history. Who was Mark Kilroy? How did he end up in Matamoros? Mark was a pre-med student at University of Texas in Austin. In March of 1989, he and a group of friends decided to go to South Padre Island, a popular spring break destination on the Texas-Mexico border. While there, they heard about a legendary party town called Matamoros, just across the border in Mexico.
Mark and his friends decided to head to Matamoros to check out what the party town had to offer. Shortly after arriving, Mark separated from his friends. Little did they know, it would be the last time they, or anyone else, would ever see him alive. The investigation into Mark's disappearance was a joint effort between Mexican and American authorities. Authorities searched the area of Matamoros and interviewed dozens of people, but were unable to locate any evidence that could help in the recovery of Mark.
That was until about a month later. A reliable tip led police to a ranch on the outskirts of Matamoros. The authorities quickly prepared to secure the ranch and collect any and all evidence that would lead to an answer for the Kilroy family. Upon entering the ranch, authorities quickly started uncovering a strange and bizarre history of events.
The investigation uncovered the ranch was run by Narco Santanicos, a satanic cult. The cult was led by Adolfo Constanzo, whose followers believed he was a powerful witch doctor. Constanzo was known to have studied voodoo and Palo Mayombe. Palo Mayombe traces back to the Congo River Basin, where offerings were made to the gods in a ceremonial cauldron. The contents of the cauldron usually contain animal bones and sticks.
Police searched the ranch and found the remains of what can only be described as a satanic ritual of human sacrifice. They ultimately found the remains of Mark and more than a dozen others. The coroner's report revealed that Mark had been tortured and sexually assaulted. The top of his head was chopped off with a machete, and his brains were cooked in a cauldron. His heart was also removed from his chest cavity, and it can only be assumed that it would have been used for cannibalistic purposes.
The investigation into the cult and its activities was a complex and challenging one. It revealed that Constanzo and his followers believed human sacrifice would bring them supernatural powers, including their associates within the Mexican cartel. One of the most significant breakthroughs in the case came when authorities arrested one of Constanzo's followers, Sarah Aldrete. The cult knew her as La Madrina, or the Godmother.
Sarah was living south of the border but was able to obtain resident alien status to attend Texas' Southmost College in Brownsville. She was known to be a good student studying for a degree in physical education. She was also a cheerleader for the school. Sarah was interviewed by the police because she had been seen with Mark Kilroy on the night he disappeared. She was eventually charged with Mark's murder along with several other cult members. But many questions remained about who took Mark's life.
Some theories suggest that Sarah and the others were merely pawns in a larger conspiracy involving drug cartels and corrupt officials. Others believe that Constanzo himself was the mastermind behind the murder and that Aldrete and the others were just following his orders. Despite these theories, Sarah Aldrete and six other members of the Narco Santanicos cult were convicted of Mark's murder. Although not much information could be found on the six members, Sarah was initially sentenced to 6 years in prison. The initial judgment was modified to a 30-year sentence after her second trial. Constanzo, however, never faced justice for his crimes.
He was said to have been killed during the police raid on the ranch, although his body was never found. Some believe he committed suicide, while others think he escaped and may still be alive today. Regardless of who was ultimately responsible for Mark's death, the case profoundly impacted both sides of the border. It exposed the dark underbelly of organized crime and the dangers of getting involved with cults. It serves as a reminder that justice can be elusive, even in the face of overwhelming evidence and public outcry.
Number 3, the story of Brian Schaefer. Brian was a 27-year-old medical student at Ohio State University in Columbus, Ohio. On the night of March 31st, 2006, he went out with his friend, William Florence, also known as Clint, to celebrate the beginning of spring break. After hopping around a few bars, Brian and Clint ended their night at the Ugly Tuna Saluna, a popular bar near the university campus. The two friends drank and socialized for hours, but around 1:15 a.m., Clint noticed that Brian was no longer with them.
Clint tried to call Brian several times, but his phone was turned off. After searching the bar and the surrounding area, he left, assuming that Brian had returned to his apartment. But when Brian didn't show up for his flight to Miami the next day, his girlfriend, Alexis Wagner, contacted the Columbus Police Department. They launched an investigation but found no sign of Brian anywhere.
The police returned to the last place Brian was seen and searched the Ugly Tuna Saluna and reviewed the bar's security footage. This showed Brian entering the bar at around 9:55 p.m. with Clint. According to the security footage, at around 1:55 a.m., when the bar was about to close, Brian was seen walking toward the bar's entrance. However, when the security cameras outside the bar were reviewed, they revealed no sign of him ever leaving. This would be the last known sighting of Brian alive.
The investigators continued to search the bar and the surrounding area, but found no sign of Brian. They even searched the nearby Olentangy River, but found no sign of him in the water. The police interviewed everyone at the bar that night, but couldn't find any witness who had seen Brian leave.
There are several theories about what happened to Brian Schaefer that night. One theory is he left the bar through a service door that was left open by mistake. However, the police ruled out this theory after thoroughly searching the bar's service areas and finding no evidence that Brian had used any of the doors. Another theory is Brian was a victim of foul play. Some believe he was attacked and killed inside the bar or the surrounding area.
There was a construction site adjacent to the bar, which could have been a potential location for Brian's body to be hidden, although the police searched the site too and found nothing. Another theory is that Brian left voluntarily, perhaps to start a new life. However, his family and friends find this theory unlikely, as he was close to completing his medical degree, his grades weren't suffering, and he was looking forward to starting his residency.
Over the years, the police have received several tips and leads, but they have yet to lead to any breakthroughs in the case. Brian's family and friends have also conducted their own search efforts by renting billboards and posting flyers nationwide. However, his disappearance still remains a mystery to this day.
Number 2, the disappearance of Brittany Drexel, a 17-year-old high school student who vanished without a trace while on spring break in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, back in 2009. It's a case that has baffled investigators over the years, and today we're going to take a closer look and shed light on the case. On April 22, 2009, Brittany Drexel left her home in Rochester, New York for a spring break trip to Myrtle Beach with some friends. Brittany's mother, Dawn, told her she was not allowed to go on this trip because of the lack of parental supervision, but Brittany chose to leave anyway.
Brittany and her friends made reservations at the Bar Harbor Hotel. After checking in with her friends that evening, they decided to venture out and explore the area, having a few nights of fun, meeting new people out on the town, and enjoying the beach. On April 25th, Brittany and her friends met up with additional friends at the Blue Water Resort. Brittany decided to leave early and began to head back to their hotel alone. She was last seen on the surveillance camera leaving the hotel at around 9 p.m. that night.
Brittany had texted her boyfriend, John Greco, who stayed back in New York for spring break, that she was heading back to the hotel. She had stayed in constant contact with him throughout the trip. When John did not hear from Brittany the next day, he got worried and contacted Dawn, who was unaware her daughter had left for Myrtle Beach, despite her saying no. The investigation into Brittany's disappearance started immediately after Dawn reported her missing. Dawn had made her way from Rochester, New York, to help search for her daughter. Police interviewed witnesses, searched the area, and even used helicopters and dogs to try to find her.
Despite their efforts, they were unable to establish any immediate leads pertaining to the whereabouts of Brittany. That was until a few days later, when the Georgetown County Sheriff's Office received a tip that Brittany might have been abducted and held against her will in a house south of Georgetown County. The Georgetown County Sheriff's Department searched the house but found no evidence that Brittany had been there. However, they did find some items that belonged to her, including her cell phone, which had been turned off.
The investigation continued for several months, with police following up on every lead they could receive. They interviewed dozens of people and even strategically searched a nearby wildlife reserve. Despite their exhaustive efforts, Brittany could not be found. Several potential suspects have emerged in the case over the years, including Brittany's friend, Peter Brozowitz, who is known to be the last person to see Brittany alive. Peter did obtain a lawyer due to the repetitive questioning he received. Despite police efforts, Peter was eventually dropped as a suspect due to the lack of evidence and having an alibi with friends confirming he stayed at the Blue Water Resort.
One of the most notable suspects is Timothy Deshaun Taylor, who is reportedly in the Myrtle Beach area at the time of Brittany's disappearance. Taylor has a criminal history, including prior convictions for robbery and assault. According to a jailhouse informant, Taylor allegedly admitted he was involved in the kidnapping and murder of Brittany Drexel. Despite this information, Taylor has never been charged in connection with Brittany's disappearance. Taylor's lawyer has also maintained his innocence, stating that no physical evidence links him to the crime.
With so few clues and several potential suspects, there are many theories about what happened to Brittany. Some people believe she was kidnapped and taken out of the area, while others think she was killed and her body was hidden in the ocean or the surrounding forest. Some speculate that she was abducted and sold by human traffickers. Myrtle Beach has been known as a hub for human trafficking, and it is possible that Brittany was kidnapped and sold into this dark and disturbing industry.
Some have theorized that Brittany may have gotten lost or injured in the nearby wildlife reserve, or that she may have drowned in the ocean. But again, there needs to be concrete evidence to support these theories. Due to the nature of this incident involving crossing state lines, the FBI became involved. For 13 years, Brittany's disappearance remained a mystery. However, in 2021, the FBI announced they had a new prime suspect, Raymond Douglas Moody. Raymond Moody was a 62-year-old convicted sex offender with a long history of violent crimes. He had been released from prison just a few months before Brittany's disappearance. Local authorities revealed that they had evidence placing Raymond in the Myrtle Beach area at the time of Brittany's disappearance.
The evidence revealed that on April 26, 2009, Raymond was issued a traffic citation near Surfside Beach, which was only 8 miles from Myrtle Beach. On May 17, 2022, Raymond Moody came forward with a confession of the murder of Brittany Drexel. He took police to the wooded area along Old Town Avenue in Harmony Township, where the remains of Brittany Drexel were found. After his confession, Raymond was charged with murder, kidnapping, and first-degree criminal sexual conduct. On October 19, 2022, Raymond's hearing took place, where he pled guilty to all charges. He was given a life sentence on the murder charge and 30 years each on the remaining charges.
When Raymond was finally able to address the courtroom, he stated, quote, "I was a monster. I was a monster then. Was a monster when I took Brittany Drexel's life. I don't have words to express how horrible I feel. I've felt ever since that day. I'm very sorry," end quote. Dawn Drexel finally put her daughter to rest, received closure for her loss, and knew the monster who took her daughter from this world too soon was behind bars for the rest of his life.
Number 1, the tragic murder of Dana Bailey. Dana was a 21-year-old student finishing her senior year at Penn State, where she was majoring in health planning and administration. She was described as friendly and well-liked. On the night of March 4, 1987, Dana returned home from Washington, D.C., where she was visiting her fiancé, Greg Greenberg.
Dana called her mother when she arrived home and told her she planned to spend spring break at her apartment near campus to catch up on schoolwork and relax. After hanging up the phone with her mother, she left her apartment to attend a fitness class nearby. She returned home around 5:30 p.m., where she worked on schoolwork and ate dinner. At around 8:30 p.m., she spoke to her fiancé on the phone one last time before heading to bed.
The next day, Greg and her mother, Shirley Bailey, had not heard from her for most of the day. Greg called Shirley and asked her to go to Dana's apartment to check on Dana. Little did Shirley know she would be walking into the scene from the Saw movies. Shirley found Dana's body tied to a chair in her bedroom. Dana was stabbed approximately 6 to 7 times in the chest. Shirley was horrified by the state she found her daughter and frantically called the police. The State College police arrived on the scene and quickly ruled this a homicide case.
The investigation revealed that the murderer likely entered through a window in the kitchen and used a knife from Dana's home to kill her. The State College police stated that the crime was lust-related. Motivated murder due to nothing being taken from the home. The police believe someone was watching Dana from the empty apartment building across from hers and likely knew some of her habits. Although Dana's death was a clear indication of homicide, the case remains open to this day. State College Bureau of Police Services Chief Elwood Williams Jr. made a public statement on March 5, 1992. Quote, "At this point, there are no witnesses to this homicide, which makes it extremely difficult to investigate. We have interviewed hundreds of people, and there is still no information at this point that would lead to an arrest," end quote.
32 years later, 3 Penn State students produced an 8-minute documentary titled Murder in Happy Valley. The documentary was originally a school project, but later turned into a hoax to provide answers to this very cold case. I highly suggest checking out their video for more information on the case. The police hope that the renewed attention on the case may bring new leads or witnesses to help solve this mysterious and brutal slaying.
That's it for this episode. Thank you all very much for taking the time to listen to our podcast. If you have any information that may lead to the resolution of any of the unsolved cases in today's episode, please call 1-800-222-TIPS. Again, that's 1-800-222-TIPS. Next month, we will travel to Eureka Springs, Arkansas, to investigate the most haunted hotel in America, the Crescent Hotel. If you like our content, please like, share, and subscribe. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram at Mystery Road Pod. Also, consider donating to our Patreon at patreon.com/Mystery Road Pod to help support the show. Links will be in the show notes.